Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. The second Syrian ceasefire has come to an abrupt end, with Washington and Moscow blaming the other. Was the ceasefire intentionally scuttled, and what happens now? Two Crosstalk stories in the media. I'm joined by my guest in Moscow, Dmitry Babich. He's a political analyst with Sputnik International. We also have Mark Sloboda. He's an international affairs and security analyst. And in London, we cross to Charles Shoebridge. He is a security analyst and former UK Army and counterterrorism intelligence officer. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I very much appreciate it. Charles, if I can go to you first in London, after the ceasefire came to an end, we had the major players in the United Nations. It's a Security Council. And U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, after listening to Sergei Lavrov, said that he felt like he was in a parallel universe. That's probably one thing that John Kerry has actually said recently that I absolutely completely agree with. The debate is in parallel universes. Go ahead, my friend.
Yes, you're absolutely right. But I think we have to differentiate between what's going on in the public domain, particularly, for example, in the amphitheater of the UN, when various bodies, particularly, I have to say, I think most objective observers, impartial observers, would look at the performance of people such as Lavrov over the last few years and then comparing that with the performance in public with the performances of people like Samantha Power with John Kerry. And you can really see, and indeed adding to that, other Western leaders, such as, for example, Cameron, I know he's gone now, and Sarkozy, other people like this, Hollande. And you can see that on one side, you've got cool, calm reflection, just putting points. And of course, both sides will be putting propaganda points. But the subtlety with which one side does it and the kind of histrionics and the theatrics with which the Western side portrays its case or presents its case, and you know, the example you've just given is one of those, I think does their case no service whatsoever, does it a disservice. But we have to differentiate, I think, between what goes on in the public theatre and what's going on behind the scenes. And one wonders whether behind the scenes, away from the glare of the public cameras, away from the lobby groups who are watching, for example, Kerry's every move, the various different interests that make up US foreign policy, whether Kerry, as a pragmatist, is actually more and more in tune with, I think, Lavrov's thinking. That certainly seems to be nudge by nudge what's going on.
You know, Mark, you know, this is one of the many secrets of this whole tragedy in dealing with Syria, because I have the impression that Lavrov has essentially laid out the roadmap for these ceasefires, and John Kerry seems to go along with it, and then at a certain point, he wanders off the reservation, because what we saw in the United Nations, it's not the usual carry that we saw in negotiating the second ceasefire.
Yeah, well, a part of the problem with U.S. diplomats like John Kerry, like with Powers, is that they are not professional diplomats, unlike their colleagues in Russia, Lavrov, Churkin. These people are professional, career diplomats, whereas U.S. figures like Kerry there and Powers, they're either political or ideological appointees, or in the case of other U.S. diplomats, they're often simply large campaign contributors. I mean, the Western media has well commented how it's just several million dollars to Obama's campaign funds that get you an ambassadorship. In this case, it's more ideological and political. But there's a lot of ambiguity in where Kerry's position.
Agreed.
A lot of people have
Agreed.
Tried to present him Agreed. As being more amenable to the Russian position. I'm not sure I believe that. There are other accounts that Kerry has long been one of the hawks, pushing Obama to a much harder position, and particularly on Syria.
And we get that. We got that from his last appearance in the Security Council, DiMA, because, I mean, I was stunned. I was astounded when he called for a no-fly zone over Syria, meaning that Russian planes and Syrian planes, Syria in its own sovereign space, would not be allowed to fly airplanes, which my immediate reaction was, well, then this is air cover for ISIS and for Nusra Front and all the other bad characters there. But no one in the Western media seemed to make that conclusion.
The only ones legally allowed to fly in Syria.
Right, exactly.
Well, that's true.
And it didn't say anything about American planes not being allowed to fly in Syria as well, which is already illegal under international law. Go ahead.
Kerry does live in a parallel universe because he as if he didn't hear that al-Nusra actually started an offensive just exactly at the moment when he was calling for that no-fly zone over northwestern Syria. And I agree with Mark that some of the statements by Kerry, not only on Syria, but, for example, on Ukraine, if you listen to his speech in Kiev right after the coup when he came there, that would make, you know, Samantha Power smile. You know, she was, she would be glad. I think that there are two persons in John Kerry. He reminds me of the Soviet diplomats of Stalin's period. You know, he, as a pragmatist, he understands that if he has his way, the United States will suffer because the Islamic State will advance, you know. But he is also an official. He has his duties. So he has to ruin the whole thing, you know. I quite agree with Mark that they are not professional diplomats. What is diplomacy? Diplomacy is the art of dissociating the personality of your interlocutor and his official business. That's why diplomats dress conservatively. That's why they try not to insult each other in public. And what did Kerry do? You know, when he tried to make fun of Lavrov, when Lavrov said that, you know, the convoy didn't look like a bombed-out convoy. You know, there were traces of fire. Mr. Kerry said, Mr. Lavrov is talking about fire here. We're not joking here. Well, I think that by his speech, Lavrov made Kerry look like a fool.
Exactly. Charles, you know, one of the, you know, we have...
Come in on
go ahead, jump in. Please do. Go right ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, of course, the convoy attack is a good case in point to bring up. And obviously, it's something we are going to bring up. It's an extremely serious incident, whichever way you look at it. But, of course, Kerry... Western leaders, Boris Johnson, the bumbling Foreign Secretary of the United Kingdom, they've all almost flatly accused Russia of carrying out this attack. The problem they've got, of course, is that the evidence is against them. Therefore, they have to, Kerry, for example, has to resort to this kind of theatrical grandstanding where accusations are made but no evidence is presented. For example, the United States could present some of its comprehensive radar signals, satellite intelligence available to the public, make it available to the public, to prove that Russian planes attacked this convoy. The fact that they haven't been able to do so and refused to do so really does suggest, as does the other evidence from the ground at this stage, more evidence may emerge, that actually it was the people who the United States effectively supports in these areas who, on the ground, who have carried out such a horrific attack. And therefore, of course, the only way they can deal with this is to just straightforwardly make assertions without evidence and then hope that the matter disappears from the front pages as quickly as possible before people look at it too closely. When one looks at it, that's what's happened in the West media with this aid convoy.
We had the collapse of the ceasefire, and then we had the attack on the convoy, which, of course, you know, the questions if there was an intentional attack by the U.S. military on the Syrian troops here. Then we have the next news cycle, not even a full news cycle. Then we have this. And just as Charles was saying, Mark, is that you change the subject. You don't want to go there. And we've seen this with MH17 and the shooting down of that aircraft over Ukraine. The same thing that Charles just said, we could just replace words. Go ahead,
Mark. This is a very convenient scenario. I mean, we can ignore the fact that Russia reports that there were over 300 U.S. proxy violations of the ceasefire. We can ignore the fact that there was a U.S. military, sustained military strike on Syrian troops fighting ISIS in a territory where the U.S. has never aided the Syrian military, or they've never actually aided the Syrian military in fighting ISIS. They've always let it go unimpeded. And then they tried to claim it was a mistake. So we can ignore that. We can ignore that they were unable to separate their proxies from Nusra, from al-Qaeda and its affiliates again,
but we had two ceasefires, and that's exactly what the United States was supposed to do. That was their primary obligation in both ceasefires. Dima, this is galling here. Again, it's not covered in Western media. Essentially, is that it is the disarming of the Syrian state after everything that has happened. Syria does not have a right to its sovereignty. It doesn't have the right to push for its own security interests. And John Kerry doesn't have one word about the people that are causing the conflict from outside at all.
Well, that's true. And sometimes I have an impression that the Western leaders forgot what they had said just recently. You know, just a few months ago, after the terrible terrorist acts in Paris,
exactly.
Mr. Hollande said that we're not fighting Mr. Assad, we're fighting ISIL, right? Now, listen to his speech at the General Assembly of the UN. How many times did he pronounce the word regime, you know?
Yeah.
The regime is his ally, actually, because the regime is fighting the people who killed dozens of people in Paris, who killed dozens of people in Nice, you know, who almost put France on its knees by the terrorist acts. And with Mr. Kerry, it's the same story. And I think I would like to point your attention to the fact that the Associated Press published, you know, this so-called secret agreement.
Parts of it, at least. Parts of it. Yeah,
or parts of it. You know, and I read it. It was all, you know, there was nothing sensational there. My impression was how paralyzed by fear is the U.S. administration, that they were afraid to publish even that.
Let me go to Charles here before we go to the break here. It's a very good point that Dima Babic brings up, because essentially the United States doesn't want the world to understand what obligations it signed up to, the separating of these moderate and not so moderate or terrorist groups. I mean, that's what they don't want publicly known. That's what should be known, and that would have probably made the ceasefire a little bit firmer. Go ahead, Charles, before we go to the break.
Well, the main problem here, of course, is again one of presentation. If that is published, it agrees with the Russian line for some time, which is that, and indeed it was a problem with the first ceasefire and ultimately with this one too. This issue of separation of so-called moderate with more extremist rebels such as al-Nusra and, of course, ISIS further afield. The big problem is this, is that Kerry, the Western establishments, they all know, of course, as is well known in Syria, but not repeated much in our media in the West, that the separation is impossible for the simple matter that without al-Nusra, in particular, right. What has become
okay,
you know,
Charles,
renamed
Charles, I'm gonna
the moderate rebels have nothing.
I'm going to jump in here, gentlemen. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on stories in the media. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Laveau. To remind you, we're discussing some of the stories that have made a difference in the media. Okay, let me go to Mark here. Mark, you know, this conflict has been going on for 5 years, and with when we had the legal intervention of Russia in last September of last year, there was a recognition that there needed to be some kind of negotiated end to this, since Russia made itself invited a major player here. But listening to John Kerry in the United Nations, I have this sense of deja vu all over again. American objectives have not changed one iota in all of this process here. And let's speak to the huge divisions that appear to be separating the White House, the CIA, the State Department, and the Pentagon.
Yeah, I mean, this was perfectly obvious in Kerry's speech to the Security Council when he, in so many words, said that Russia should refrain from attacking al-Nusra, and that the U.S. could never separate its proxies from their jihadi allies unless Russia stopped attacking Nusra.
I don't understand the logic.
There is no logic. Of course, the logic is that, you know, they're just a small force used as human shields and PR, you know, within the larger al-Qaeda jihadi framework.
Dima, you know, if the Syrian government were to say, you know, you have 24 hours to separate, to, you know, get out of Dodge. Mm-hmm. And if you don't get out of Dodge, we will bomb you and there will be consequences.
Mm-hmm.
That is a very straightforward, but the United States is a country that objects to that. It is not indiscriminate bombing. Mm-hmm. They know who these people are. I mean, considering the United States spends the most money on surveillance in the world, I find it galling that they didn't know who they were bombing.
Well, I think that was a terrible act in the Azores. And the fact that the United States did not apologize for several days before making something that looked like an apology, you know. I heard Samantha Power, she did not sound apologetic at all.
Regret.
Yeah,
she used the word regret.
It was
not an apology.
Intention.
That's
you know,
not an apology.
I had an impression that Mitt Romney is still running the United States because he said he was unapologetic about the U.S. might. And you know, the people in the United Nations who represent the United States, they behave as if Mitt Romney were in power. But I think I know the logic in the behind the actions of the U.S. officials here. That logic is fear. They're afraid of a favor. They're afraid that they would fail to oust Assad. They're not afraid of losing American people, American lives, like they did in Iraq, because no one was punished for that, yeah, right? They're not afraid of destroying the whole region. They're afraid of failing, you know. For them, the favor is
a prestige. No, but I mean, if, going using your logic, if they fail, that means who wins? They don't want the perception would be the Russians
yeah.
have won.
Well, I mean, I have the same impression when I read the American press actually blasting Donald Trump all the time. Why do they go to such lengths? The only explanation that I can find, and I know it from our Soviet history, that is fear. You know, Mr. Obama is afraid that he would be the first American president to be replaced by someone outside the system, you know. They can forgive him another Iraq. They can forgive him anything. They can't forgive him. That for the first time in 300 years, someone different would replace him,
okay.
you know.
It's very interesting. Charles, for argument's sake here, the Americans and their allies would say is that Russia has to do more to put pressure on Assad. Because, I mean, the ceasefire has come about when you see the Syrian government making advances. There are good reasons to see, for the Syrians to say, well, the ceasefire isn't going to work because as we speak right now, the Syrian government has announced that we'll have a major campaign, comprehensive campaign was the word, to liberate all of Aleppo here. How important is Aleppo here? Is this the game changer?
Yes, there's no doubt about it. Aleppo, obviously, it's the most important city. Damascus is vitally important, but the largest, most economically important city was always Aleppo. Let's not forget as well that Aleppo, in Aleppo, there was no so-called revolution at all.
Right,
there was
right.
Little in the way of uprising. It was attacked from the outside. The situation there now is that, we're talking about the way that Western media and Western politicians are dealing with this situation. We have a myth created in the West media, that is that, first of all, there is this large number of so-called moderate rebels. Of course, they cannot be separated from al-Nusra and groups like this because, as I was saying before, al-Nusra, without al-Nusra and groups like them, the so-called moderate rebels are nothing. And the other aspect of this, is, which is largely underreported in the West, is that there have been, over the last few years, and is still continuing to this day, an ongoing process of local ceasefires between Assad's government's troops and what might be called moderate rebels in local areas, for example, of Damascus. And these are bringing, slowly but surely, reconciliation and peace to those areas. And after that, the political process can be considered. There's a massive disconnect, of course, what the Western politicians and the media say and what the reality is on the ground. Think about Aleppo being portrayed as some liberal establishment or liberal enclave under assault. It's largely under the control of groups like al-Nusra, the people that carried out, in their broader sense, the attacks on 9/11 and 7/7. And that is largely forgotten in all of this.
Well, I have never heard about liberals using suicide bombers to attack government troops. You know, everyone knows that in Aleppo, just a few weeks ago, the rebels used suicide bombers, and the Saudi cleric was actually leading that offensive. So the fact that people in the West continue to believe that they have moderates and civilian population cursing Assad.
But that's Mark, that's the only way they can sell it. It's the only way they can sell it because they can't say openly that the groups that they're backing are terrorists or terrorist-like groups with very odious ideologies, and they happen to be against Assad. So they're picking that side here, okay? But I want to ask you a question.
Let me come in very
really quick, Charles. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say it's very important the methods that are being used here. This is a sophisticated PR operation. Look at, for example, the domination of the media at the moment and for months now of the so-called white helmets, for example, a humanitarian aid group. But when one looks a little bit deeply into it, you can see this is part of, notwithstanding any good work that they do, and they may well do some, but primarily their function, as so much in this war, is a PR anti-Assad pro-Western policy operation. And we can see that in all of our Western media.
Well, I hear that they're going to be nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize. But Mark, it's very important. Let's explain to our viewers here. Two ceasefire attempts, both failures. But the Russians say, let's continue negotiations. Why would the Russians do this? I mean, if you're lied to once, fine. Lied to twice, fine. I mean, what's the point? Or is it just the Russian approach that you always keep talking to resolve conflict?
Yeah, I think there is an element to that Russia, recognizes that at some point there has to be a political settlement. But I think beyond the rhetoric of continuing talks, I think finally perhaps the Russian government might have drawn a line with the attack, the U.S. attack on the Syrian troops and said, we'll continue to talk and the door will always be open. But we're moving forward to liberate East Aleppo at this point. And I think the military actions in the last few days show that. And this is going to leave the U.S. in a bit of a bind. There's a further problem here is that both Churkin and Lavrov brought up is who is in charge of U.S. foreign policy in Syria?
Point.
They
deliberately
brought up and said, who's in charge? Is it the Pentagon or the White House? We heard the New York Times reported earlier this week that Pentagon officials testifying to the Senate said they didn't know yet whether they would adhere to the terms of the ceasefire.
Maybe yes, maybe no was the answer.
Maybe yes. And cooperate and share intelligence information with her. We don't know. So that means, essentially, they're saying we don't know whether we will obey the orders of our civilian commander-in-chief, the president. And that shows how weak Obama has been. He has tried, he farmed out Ukrainian foreign policy to Joe Biden. He has farmed out contradictory, mutually exclusive foreign policies in Syria, support of the FSA to the CIA, support of the Kurdish, the YPG, to the Pentagon, the Turks, and they're all fighting each other. And I think there's a lot of reason to believe, there's a lot of suspicion within the Western media as well, that these military strikes against the Syrian troops in Deir ez-Zor may have been a rogue Pentagon going out of its way to break up a ceasefire that they never wanted and never intended to adhere to.
And for the explicit reason is that if this ceasefire had got off the ground, if it had gotten some legs, is that the next step would have been Russia and the United States would have worked jointly. Is that what Ashton Carter was most concerned about? Because he doesn't want, because it doesn't fit into his global scheme of recreating the Cold War as Russia being the enemy.
And the Russian Foreign Minister, Sergei Lavrov, noted that precisely at the moment when they signed that agreement on monitoring the process, one of the heads of U.S. intelligence was saying it would not be a good idea to share intelligence with the Russians. I mean, we saw it all on television, on American television. And on the white helmets, I would like to note to Charles that actually, if Gorbachev got the Nobel Peace Prize, if Arafat got it, if Obama got it, let the white helmets get it. Because obviously, a Nobel Prize winner is someone who fights for peace to the point when there is not a stone upon stone left in a certain area, right?
Don't forget Kissinger.
That's what happened in the former Soviet Union, in a lot of parts of it, after Gorbachev became the Nobel Prize winner. That's what happened to the Palestinian territories after Arafat's winning it. Now let the white helmets have their peace prize.
Charles, let me go back to your last word on the program here. Where do we go from here? Because on Crosstalk here, we've been discussing this war since it started and with intensity over the last couple of years. And I'm at a loss now. Where do we go?
First of all, this key question of the divergent interests that make up a very incoherent U.S. foreign policy need to be taken a grip of. That requires strong leadership, and ultimately that must come from Obama, who is leaving, of course. But secondly, we need to remember, I think both countries appreciate this, that it is in their fundamental interests, I know some will disagree with me on this, that there is peace and stability in these regions of both Russia and of the interests of the United States for trade and other things. But the problem is with U.S. foreign policy, it is so betrothed, should we say, so beheld to outside external influences, such as, for example, the influence of Saudi Arabia, of Israel, of Qatar, and that applies to the whole of the West foreign policy, that there needs to be a disconnection made, if you like,
okay,
between the West.
Okay, Charles, I have to jump in. We've run out of time. I want to thank my guests here in Moscow and in London, and thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time, and remember, Crosstalk rules. I love you.